The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. I want to start out today by proclaiming my boundless affection for everyone who donated in support of Skeptically Speaking over the last few weeks. You have not only renewed my hope and faith in humanity, especially in its interest in science and critical thinking, but you've also helped to financially sustain a radio station that really, really deserves to feel the love. Tokens of our appreciation, in the form of Skeptically Speaking buttons, are on their way to you, as well as any prizes to anyone who won them in the draws. If you haven't received them in the next few weeks, do send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com so we can right this horrible wrong post-haste. And again, in all seriousness, thanks very, very much for all of your support. Now, today's episode is extremely food-centric. We'll be talking to Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food. But first up, let's find out about food allergies on Speaking Up. I'm here with Dr. Gary Stadtmauer. He teaches in the Allergy Fellowship Program at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine and maintains a private practice in Manhattan. He also runs an educational website, cityallergy.com, which is dedicated to both patient and physician allergy education. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you.
So what does having an allergy to a certain food actually mean?
Well, an allergy means that the immune system is involved, that either through an antibody response or through what is called a cellular response, that a learned immunologic response occurs. It is acquired in the same way that, let's say, one acquires immunity to influenza through the flu vaccine or through natural illness. Of course, the outcome of the immune response is different. But the idea is that it's a learned response as opposed to other conditions which people confuse with food allergies.
Now, you say confuse with food allergies. What does that mean?
Intolerance is different than allergy. And intolerance is a non-immunologic response. So, for instance, an intolerance could be lactose intolerance. That's one of the more classic examples. And that is an enzyme deficiency. It's not an allergy. And this is a dose-response relationship. If you have a dairy intolerance, then the more milk you drink, the more sick you will become. But the response is usually reproducible. That is, if you drink a quart of a cup of milk and you get sick the first time you do it, it's going to be the same the 20th time you drink a quarter of a cup of milk. With allergies, allergic responses sometimes tend to be amplified. That is, heightened exposure can lead to a more severe immune response. I sometimes have to explain to patients in a very simple way why they're not allergic to something. And I tell them that people tend to use the term allergic very freely. That is, anything that disagrees with them is an allergy. Well, you know, that's why you see people wearing t-shirts that say, "I'm allergic to work." I mean, I think they know it's not a real immune response.
Right.
Okay, they like it. It doesn't agree with them. So I get people who come to see me for all kinds of reasons that they think are allergic, and it's not. You know, what happens is that somebody breaks out in a rash. Maybe the rash is poison ivy. Maybe the rash is related to a virus. But what do they think about? They think, well, what did I do recently? What did I eat recently? Did I take a medicine? So there are people who walk around, let's say, thinking they're allergic to Advil or Tylenol or penicillin, when really they had no allergic response. They just developed a rash for some other cause. And the same for food allergies. So there is this tendency to look for approximate cause. People do that in allergy very routinely. The problem also is that if you see a general physician or someone who is not experienced with allergy and you ask them, well, could I be allergic to this food? And the doctor runs a blood test. Well, the blood tests are not 100% reliable. And so you could get a false positive result. And then the patient walks around thinking they're allergic to these things. And it's sometimes not the case.
Are there different kinds of tests? You mentioned a blood test.
For food allergies, there is a blood test, which is reasonably accurate in the right setting, but the blood test is not yes or no. There is a range, and the range is from undetectable to, let's say, over 100. And for different allergens, there are specific cutoffs. So let's say if you have a 10-year-old child who seems to have a peanut allergy, and you run the test, and their blood level comes back as 65. Well, it turns out that for a certain blood test called a CAPRAST, the levels over 15 are 95% predictive of an allergic response to peanut. But it doesn't tell you how severe their peanut allergy is. They may have mild hives or they may have anaphylaxis. The level doesn't tell us that. It just tells us that they're 95% likely to have a true peanut allergy. But there is no level below which you can say absolutely someone is not allergic, because about 20% of people who have a negative blood test for peanut allergy will actually have the true peanut allergy. That is where the role comes in for skin testing, where a minute amount of an extract of a food is placed on the skin, and the skin surface is scratched, and if someone develops a small hive at the site, then that tends to be predictive of food allergy, but even that is not 100%, because everything always needs to be interpreted in light of somebody's symptoms. And so if there is a discordance between the symptoms and the test, you generally have to look to the symptoms and see if the symptoms make sense. If somebody says they get a headache every time they eat walnuts, and that's their only symptom, that's not likely to be a food allergy.
Well, is there any way to actually test for the severity of the reaction?
You would really have to do a food challenge. That is, administer a small but increasing amount over time and observe to see what happens.
So how often do people that think that they are allergic to a food go get tested and it turns out they're not?
That depends on the practice. I would say it might be a third or a half the time that people come in thinking that they have a food allergy, and it's not the case. But it also depends how good my staff is at screening the calls. My staff know that if somebody develops gas and bloating as their only symptom after they eat apple pie, well, maybe that patient should see a gastroenterologist first.
So are there different kinds of tests for different food allergies?
The way for us to look at this is to break things down into intolerance versus allergy. And allergy can be broken down into different types of food allergies. The intolerance we talked about, there are enzyme deficiencies. The classic enzyme deficiency, as I mentioned, is lactose intolerance. But there are also people who have an intolerance of the fruit sugar, fructose. Then when we get into the arena of true food allergies, we have to break it down further into what are called immediate hypersensitivities. That is the classic allergic reaction to food where people have immediate symptoms, and this can include hives and difficulty breathing. And this is a condition due to massive histamine release from the allergic cells. And depending upon severity, people will need either antihistamines for mild symptoms or even adrenaline. And this is really the life-threatening allergic reaction that we worry about the most with food allergy. And this is really why food allergy gets so much attention, because every year a few hundred people die because of food allergy. And very often they're young people. And the risk factors for a fatal anaphylactic reaction are a delay in giving adrenaline or having severe asthma, because having severe asthma that's not well controlled means that someone's airways are already somewhat narrower and they're, let's say, that much closer to having a fatal respiratory allergic response to a food. The most common allergens are peanut, shellfish, and fish. That tends to be in adults. Those are lifelong allergies. Kids tend to have allergies to also dairy, eggs, soy, sometimes wheat, and those are often outgrown. But the other immunologic responses that are not immediate could be gluten intolerance. And gluten intolerance isn't really an intolerance, because it is a true inflammatory allergic response, but it's not histamine related. It's not an immediate response. Instead, it's a gradual inflammatory response in the intestinal tract, and that leads to malabsorption anemia, sometimes osteoporosis, and it is of more subtle onset. People can rarely have a rash, but usually it's fatigue and chronic gastrointestinal symptoms, and that affects about 1% of the population, but the incidence is four times higher amongst people who have irritable bowel syndrome. And that's important to know because IBS, or irritable bowel, is something that's really common. And those are the people who often go everywhere trying to find an answer. They see the acupuncturist, they come to see allergists, they see the gastroenterologist, and they're just told, well, it's IBS, but then they're looking for answers. Now, some of them may have fructose deficiency. Maybe they have a bit of lactose intolerance, but they could have this gluten intolerance, which is really known as celiac disease. And then, you know, in kids, there are a lot of inflammatory conditions. There's a type of colitis, which is also not due to histamine. There are these weird conditions of the intestinal tract related to allergic cells called eosinophils, and that's almost too complicated to get into, but allergy testing may be negative for those people as well.
You do mention children growing out of allergies. Now that happens, but also there's later onset allergies as well.
By the time people are in their 40s to 50s, they're pretty much done developing new onset allergies. You can see it in their 20s and 30s. A very typical type of food allergy we see of adult onset is something called oral allergy syndrome. And that is usually not a serious allergy. It's also called the pollen fruit syndrome. That is, people who develop bad hay fever eventually become allergic to proteins in fruits that cross-react with pollen proteins. So let's say you develop worsening hay fever to birch pollen. Your allergic antibodies to birch pollen rise, and as they do, those antibodies start to recognize proteins that are present in a lot of pitted fruits. So they'll have reactions to peaches, plums, cherries, apples, and they usually just get a little itching in the back of their throat and not much else. Very rarely that could be more serious. It's really rare to have a life-threatening allergic response to something in the food protein family. And yes, we do see nut allergy of new onset in older people. Sometimes what happens is that cross-reactivity, just like it happens with the fruit pollen syndrome, happens with other respiratory allergens and can be more serious. Like years ago, I saw a patient who had anaphylaxis, like the full-blown thing, after eating buckwheat pancakes. Now, why did she become buckwheat allergic in her 40s? Buckwheat allergy is common in Japan, but not so much here. We don't eat as much buckwheat. It turns out that she had been given a buckwheat pillow, and over the years, exposure to the buckwheat in the pillow led to respiratory symptoms. So she was sensitized by the respiratory route. She was sneezing, she had itchy nose. Eventually, she just threw away the pillow. But being sensitized led to an allergic reaction when she ingested buckwheat. And that has also happened with latex allergy. Natural rubber latex, which comes from the rubber tree, also cross-reacts with certain food allergens, especially avocado, kiwi, banana, and chestnut. And there are cases of people who have, let's say, worked the whole day as, let's say, a nurse or a doctor in the hospital. They're having allergic symptoms. They go home, they eat a banana, and then they have a full-blown respiratory arrest.
You have a fascinating gig.
You know, we have come across some really cool stuff over the years. Cross-reactivity in allergy is a very interesting concept. And explaining it to patients is like, you know, sometimes what I'll use is the lock and key analogy. Sometimes the keys look so alike that they can actually open up another lock, even though they're not really identical.
So the initial reason that I wanted to have you on the show was actually to discuss food dyes. Is it possible to have an allergy to them?
You can, but it's uncommon. I have a colleague who had a patient who was allergic to anise, which is an extract from licorice. But the dyes themselves may cause a different sort of immune response. They may just cause, let's say, a contact dermatitis, that if somebody who uses them may develop a rash on their hands, but not necessarily a life-threatening allergic reaction. There's a condition called chronic urticaria, which is just people who have hives every day. And we now have a much better sense for what causes chronic hives, but 20, 30 years ago, when people were looking for answers, they looked at food dyes, they looked at dental problems, you know, in the 50s, before there were even antihistamines, before Benadryl was on the market, people had their teeth pulled because doctors thought, well, you know, there's a dental infection, or it's the fillings or something like that. People did dreadful things to get control of it. And yeah, they also tried to attribute it to food dyes. And, you know, what would happen is that somebody would say, okay, take all the food dyes out of your diet. And they would do that, and then eventually their hives would go away. Well, hives do eventually just go away on their own. So knowing that, it's hard to ascribe resolution of chronic hives to a food dye or any other food.
Usually during our Speaking Up segments, we don't take audience questions. But as soon as we posted the fact that you would be on the show this week on our website, I started to receive many audience questions. So we won't be able to get to all of them at all. But we have one from Marion. Does banning peanuts in school actually make a severely allergic child safer, or do you think that we'd be better off with educating parents, teachers, and the students?
That's a really controversial issue. I think that there are some kids who have such severe, life-threatening food allergies that I could understand the reason that parents would want to have control over the environment. The thing is, how do we choose peanut? I mean, there are kids who are just as likely to have a severe reaction to walnuts or to dairy or to egg. So which food do we eliminate? You know, maybe peanut is the one that scares people the most, but people die of dairy allergy too.
And I have a question from Yovella. I have several food allergies. The most annoying are eggs and coconut. These two products are found in a lot of things. My friend has tried NAET and has said it was successful for her. I don't want to waste my money if it really doesn't work, as it's $60 a session and I don't have insurance coverage. So does NAET work, or will I be wasting my money? So maybe let's start with, what is NAET?
NAET, as I just Googled, is Nambudripad's Allergy Elimination Technique, a revolutionary and holistic treatment for the permanent elimination of anybody who naturopathically claims they can get rid of food allergies is committing malpractice. I think I could state that pretty clearly, especially, you know, in fact, they probably would not want to touch someone who has a serious life-threatening peanut allergy. I can tell you that there are doctors now who are experimenting with what sort of comes close to a naturopathic or holistic approach to food allergy, and it's with food desensitization, where they actually give people a tiny amount of the food that they are allergic to, and they increase it. But that is experimental, because if you have a really true food allergy, so for instance, if you develop hives and an asthma attack and vomiting when you eat coconut, you don't want to do this on your own, because you need to be under medical supervision. It really depends how severe the allergies are to begin with. You know, they found that people who have egg allergy can sometimes tolerate baked egg. A lot of kids with egg allergy can tolerate baked egg products. So this NAET thing, in my opinion, is definitely not worth your money.
So where can people go for more information about food allergies? Reputable information.
The Food Allergy Network is an excellent educational resource. And actually, if you are allergic, you can register online and they will send you announcements of mislabeled foods or accidental contamination of foods that are supposedly free of food allergens. And all that is free, and they are at foodallergy.org. The other useful site is the Food Allergy Initiative, which is www.faiusa.org. And on their website, you can also have access to free restaurant cards. So if you're traveling, the restaurant cards have all of the allergens listed on them. So there's an English version and, let's say, a Spanish version. What you would do is compare the English to Spanish and find the allergen that you cannot tolerate, and that's the one you'd want to highlight, and then you would show that to your waiter. So that's an excellent free resource. And I would really encourage people to go to those sites.
You know, I have so many other questions, and I realize that the audience probably does as well. So I'm going to consider this your introduction to Skeptically Speaking, and I would love to do a whole show with you soon.
I'd be delighted.
Thanks very much for being here, Dr. Stadtmauer.
My pleasure.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes, and while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm on the line with Jeff Potter, who has a background in software engineering. He's worked with a number of web and tech startup companies, usually writing code and building the first prototype of a product. Somewhere along the way, he decided to write a book, Cooking for Geeks: Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
So from coding to cooking, sir, how'd that happen?
I guess I could say I was hungry. It happened because I was lucky to have parents that cooked with me growing up as a kid. And when I got to college, I discovered that a lot of my classmates didn't know how to cook. And so I just cooked for them. And for the last 10 years or so, I had been cooking for friends. And kind of through that time, getting asked, well, why do you do this or why do you do that? And at some point, the opportunity came up to actually sit down and really think about it and write a book. And so here I am.
Well, how does hacking relate to cooking?
You know, it depends on your definition of hacking. To me, hacking is looking at something and using it in a way that it wasn't originally designed for. And so this is something that the script writers for MacGyver excelled at. I mean, they could put him into some crazy situation and all he would have would be duct tape, chicken wire, and bubble gum, and somehow he could build a boat to cross a river to save whatever. And in his case, it really came down to looking at things and seeing other possibilities of what could be done with them. When it comes to the kitchen, the same thing is true. We have lots of tools in the kitchen, but so often we only see those tools for their normal use. And we don't really stop and step back and think, hey, what else can I do with this? And when it comes to cooking, it's really about what you're doing with the food, not so much the tool that you're working with. And so there are a lot of examples. The one I like to give is actually of roasting a bell pepper. I was somewhere on the road traveling, and there was no broiler, but they had a toaster. And I'm thinking to myself, well, wait a second. When you use a toaster, it's just radiant heat. It's coming from the side as opposed to, you know, coming from the top where it would be in a broiler. But I sliced up the bell pepper and I dropped it into the toaster. And sure enough, you can roast a bell pepper that way. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's the best way to do it, but it's a way of going into the kitchen and looking at something in a different way than it was originally envisioned for. And from that, you can kind of start to explore other possibilities. And so really, it's that mindset. It's that ability to walk into a kitchen, have some particular goal that you want to get to, and then see how you can get there with what you have.
This is not your normal cookbook, sir.
No, it is not.
Well, actually, in some places, it's quite similar to a technical manual.
It really is a book about food science. And there are around 100 recipes in the book, but the recipes are really there to illustrate the food science. And so if you're going to go into the kitchen and cook a dinner, you have to understand essentially what it is you're trying to do. Now, if you follow a recipe, it may come out, and most of the time it does. But when something goes wrong, the recipe doesn't really tell you how to correct it. Because recipes are pretty much just execution. They're just steps. Do this, do that, and, you know, hopefully it comes out. But if you have some food science background and something starts to go wrong, you can say, oh, well, this is probably going wrong because there's not enough water or not enough moisture in this loaf of bread, maybe, let's say. How can I fix that? And with a little bit of food science, it actually turns out to be much easier to correct errors in the kitchen or even to come up with new ideas and create new concepts.
It's interesting because you actually have troubleshooting sections like a technical manual.
Well, there is one diagram in the book, which is a flow chart for how to make the perfect pizza. Given that my background is computer science, pizza is part of my background, undoubtedly. But really, the book itself has, in a lot of ways, like a lot of charts and diagrams saying, here are the really important temperatures in cooking. So just take an egg. When you go to cook an egg, different proteins begin to coagulate and denature at different temperatures. And just being able to understand what those temperature points are means that when you walk into a kitchen, you have a better chance of turning out a really good soft-poached egg or really good scrambled eggs.
You talk about isolating variables, actually.
Yes. Let's take a loaf of bread, because everybody understands kind of what a loaf of bread looks like. Generally, a good loaf of bread has a nice brown outside crust, and the middle has this light brown, maybe it's white depending upon the flour, but you know, it has a particular structure. When it comes to baking a loaf of bread, you really need to get the outside up to at least 310 degrees for something called the Maillard reaction to occur. This is a reaction between proteins in the flour and simple sugars that result, the protein and the sugar basically combine and then they break down, forming hundreds of compounds, some of which are brown and some of which smell really good. But that reaction doesn't begin to occur until around 310 degrees. And then the middle of that loaf of bread needs to get to around 205, 210 degrees. It's somewhere around there for the starches to actually absorb water and gelatinize and set up correctly. So there's two variables there. And when it comes to baking bread, you're essentially racing the clock, where you put the room temperature dough into a hot environment and you're trying to get the outside to 310 and the middle to 205 at the same time. The same thing is true with something like steak. A really good medium-rare steak is cooked to around 135, 140 degrees Fahrenheit in the interior. But again, the outside needs to get to 310 degrees to get that really rich brown outside with all those aromas that we desire in things like cooked steak. So you've got two variables there. And with something like steak, there are ways of actually cooking a steak where you create those two variables independently. So if you take a steak and you actually put it into an environment, a water bath, this is actually a cooking technique called sous vide. If you put it into a water bath at around 135, 140 degrees, the entire piece of steak comes up to that temperature. And you essentially have your internal temperature done. Then you remove it from that environment and you drop it into maybe something like a really hot cast iron pan, or you put it under a broiler and you take the outside of that meat to 310 degrees. In this case, the exterior temperature. And by doing this, you've essentially taken those two variables that are normally dependent because of the cooking environment and made them independent. And you can actually turn out essentially a perfectly cooked steak without any risk of either overcooking the inside or undercooking the outside.
I am very much enjoying this.
I hope I'm not making you hungry.
Kind of, actually. That's fine, though. I don't mind that.
That is the danger of talking about food, especially when we start talking about chocolate, because, well, some things are just universally delicious.
Okay, now I'm wondering about this variable thing. So if you have a recipe that goes wrong, then you have to isolate the variable that went wrong, I would assume.
Right.
Now that definitely has the potential of annoying your friends and family, because I am assuming that those are the people who are going to be trying this.
If it gets that far, but really in so many ways, once you understand a little bit of the food science, you can actually predict those things from going wrong even before they begin to veer off course. Or if they do veer off course, you can very quickly correct them to a point where no one's going to even really notice. Let me give you an example of actually where food science can actually help you turn out a meal in a way that you might not expect. I made chicken noodle soup for friends of mine last week. Their dog, unfortunately, has gone missing. Wonderful dog. And she's off in the woods somewhere and nobody knows. And they're completely distraught. And so chicken noodle soup just seemed like the perfect comfort food for them. But I didn't have a lot of time. I had like maybe 30 minutes to kind of put this together. And so I said to myself, okay, well, what's involved in chicken noodle soup? Well, chicken noodles and soup. The chicken really is ideally cooked to around 140 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, there are food safety issues there. You actually have to hold it at that temperature for long enough to properly pasteurize anything like salmonella that might be present. But once properly held for time, it's perfectly safe, and texturally, it's actually ideal. But if you put that chicken into broth, into stock, and actually boil it, it's going to get too hot, and it's going to actually overcook and become dry. And so if you're trying to make a really good chicken noodle soup, you actually should cook the chicken separate from the soup. And the same thing is actually true for things like carrots, onions, and celery that you might put into that soup base. If you want to actually get them browned up and get caramelization and Maillard reactions to occur, that needs to happen before it hits that soup liquid, because that soup liquid, by definition, is not going to get any hotter than 212 degrees, and those reactions don't occur until higher temperatures. And so what I did was I cooked the carrots, onions, and celery separately in a pan, a little bit of butter or olive oil, and then after they had gotten that browning reaction, I then transferred them to the soup. I dropped the noodles into the soup, let them cook, and then after about 10 minutes, to the point where the pasta was done, I took the chicken, actually put the chicken into the bowls I was going to serve with, and then ladled the soup, the pasta, carrot, onion, and celery mixture onto the bowls, and then served it. And it was very simple, but it came out delicious. The chicken wasn't overcooked, it had great flavor, and actually it was really simple. So I know it's like a really long answer and it sounds complicated, but really ultimately it's actually very simple. There's a handful of really kind of key lessons in food science that once you know, you can walk into a kitchen and you're not going to be confused why something might go wrong, because you simply have a better understanding. You have a better model of how that cooking works.
Can you actually hear my stomach rumble over that? Because you're killing me, sir, honestly.
I apologize. Food safety and pathogens and parasites and fish, if that will, you know, help.
It did. Thank you.
Okay.
Now we actually have a question from the chat room.
Why is chocolate universally delicious, and why do some people say they're addicted? Is it possible to really get addicted to a food? And that's from Kylie Sturgis.
Thank you, Kylie. Yes, I think people can get addicted to foods. And I say that both jokingly and seriously. Jokingly in that you might have certain cravings for particular foods. I'm not a mental health professional, so I really can't talk to the levels at which it might become disabilitating to your normal routine. Chocolate has a lot of interesting compounds in them. There's one compound in it, which is thermobrine, I think. I'm probably not even saying that right. I tend to read these things and rarely pronounce them, which is kind of the, you know, suspected, you know, oh, people love it because of this. I think it's probably just well-liked because it's delicious, has sugar, is saved for special occasions. Not being a chocolatier, I can't really get too technical on the answer. I can say that chocolate's actually very interesting from a science point of view. When it comes to the melting point of chocolate, we normally kind of think of it just melting, but it actually turns out that cocoa fats that are present actually can take one of six different crystalline structures. And this is where tempering chocolate comes into play. Some of these structures, called form 5 and form 6, are actually lead to a pleasurable texture where it has a nice snap and it essentially is good. Forms 1 through 4 lead to kind of a crumbly, like not very good chalky kind of texture. Now, the thing here is it's not that these are six distinct different fats. It's that the actual cocoa fat can take one of these six different shapes, hence the term polymorph, multiple shape. And when it comes to tempering, what you're really doing is heating up the chocolate to a point where all six of those polymorphs are melted, and then cooling it down just below the point where form 5 and form 6 polymorphs will set, but above the point where forms 1 through 4 set. And then when you hold it at that tempering stage long enough, essentially what you get is most of the cocoa fats being in the desirable polymorphs. So this is a little bit of a side on the science of chocolate, but it's just to say that it's actually structurally very complicated and chemically quite complicated as well. So I don't know if there is a simple answer as to why is chocolate like universally loved, but I'm certainly happy that we have chocolate because I love it too.
Audience, you're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food. If you have questions, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So, Jeff, you do cover a little of everything in the book. There are interviews and recipes and many, many wonderful random facts. And it turns out that cups are different sizes in different countries?
Yes, I found this really fascinating. I was totally surprised. It's not even just that there are different number of milliliters per cup measure in different countries. It's that in the same country, it can actually differ depending upon what standard you're using. So in the U.S., I think the USDA defines it as 240 milliliters, although an actual bona fide cup here would be 238 milliliters. I believe in Canada, a cup is 250 milliliters.
It is.
Which makes the math easier for you guys. Here, we don't really deal with liters, so we don't have this conversion problem. I kind of wonder if you go to a pub and order a pint of Guinness, if you're going to get more in Canada.
You know, we should test that. I believe that's worthy of an experiment.
Absolutely.
I was also unaware that eating poppy seed bagels could cause one to test positive for heroin. And actually, this was recently in the news. I believe it was just 2 days ago. A mother had her child taken away because she ate a with-everything bagel the day before. Absolutely. And I'll post this as a link on the site later.
I did not see this. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
So how does this work?
I don't directly know, but I could take an educated guess. And my educated guess would go along the lines, where does heroin come from? We'll start there, right? So essentially, when you're doing a test for heroin, I would imagine that you're looking for certain particular compounds, proteins, what have you, and those compounds are present in poppy seed. So I do remember a number of years ago, there was somebody traveling through, I think it was Dubai, who had like gone walking in a field that had poppy seeds, and he had three poppy seeds stuck to the mud on the bottom of his shoe. And Dubai has a zero tolerance policy, and I do mean zero. I don't know how long he was in prison for, but it was something absolutely insane like that. That even my educated guess essentially is like, when you talk about what a drug test is, it's essentially we're looking for a particular set of chemical compounds, and poppy seeds have those compounds. So how do you design a better test? You'd have to test for something that would be present in heroin that's not present in poppy seed. And perhaps that test would be more expensive. Perhaps it's not feasible, or there's not a known test to do that. But that does really seem, since the poppy seed heroin link is a well-known one, people who are being tested for drug stuff, you know, inmates have gone out and are coming back for periodic testing, and they're told, don't eat poppy seed bagels because we can't tell if you were doing heroin or if you had poppy seed bagels. So we will have to assume you did heroin, so don't eat poppy seed bagels. But it would seem like in the case of the mother, there has to be, I would hope that there is something more to that story.
They admitted that it was definitely due to the poppy seed bagel afterwards, but I believe that they did take her child away for 3 days. And it was a newborn. So do keep that in mind, folks, with your poppy seeds.
And poppy seeds are so delicious.
I know.
I mean, a really good poppy seed lemon loaf is fantastic.
Now, on the chemical compound idea here, brown bananas, they have the same chemical ingredients that honeybees use to signal attacks. I did not know that. So how can we use that information? It seems like there should be some kind of application.
If you're teaching chemistry in a college, you really should not synthesize those banana esters and those flavors during the height of bee season, because the attack bees will take them as pheromones and go on the rampage. So I suppose you could actually, the appropriate season, it would seem like an absolutely evil prank. But you could, you know, presumably douse something with some amount of that compound and the bees would go after it. I don't really think that's particularly funny, though. The thing about food is essentially a chemical. If you're talking about a carrot or corn on the cob or cow or chocolate, all things that begin with the letter C for some reason, these are all essentially piles of chemicals. And nature and signaling for attack bees or looking at poppy seeds and heroin, like, these things are all chemistry. They're all chemically based. So you have to think, when you go to the kitchen and you're cooking, essentially you are working with chemicals and doing chemistry. And so there's a couple of interesting places where this comes up. You know, a lot of people are very anti-chemical in their food, but what does that really mean? Well, okay, maybe you're really against pesticides and you want to go for organic food. Well, what does that really mean? Because organic food can have pesticides in it too. They just have to be organic pesticides. In the case of some organic pesticides, you know, they're not necessarily as well studied as conventional pesticides. So it really comes down to having a better understanding that food is chemical, and understanding how that interacts with you, at least means you can kind of begin to have a dialogue about where our food comes from, what does it mean from a chemistry point of view. And actually, the other kind of fun bit about chemicals and food is when it comes to looking at compatibility of ingredients. How do you know what ingredients are going to taste well together? You can actually look at the chemistry of it. And if you have chemicals in, say, something like chocolate that are similar enough to compounds in other foods, there's a good chance that the two ingredients will actually play well together. And so while the idea of chocolate and cilantro might seem kind of crazy at first, there actually might be some chemical similarity in that case. And there's actually a researcher, I think he's in Belgium, Bernard Lehoos, who has a website called foodpairing.com that actually gives these great maps where you basically type in something like chocolate, and it'll give you a map of a whole bunch of different foods that are actually chemically similar. Ginger is similar, and actually that cilantro example I gave you is similar as well. And so we haven't exactly seen chocolate, cilantro, truffles. You have seen plenty of things like chocolate, ginger, or chocolate and coconut, or chocolate and strawberry, chocolate and raspberry. These are all things that actually are chemically similar. So it's a very kind of long overview of chemistry and chemicals in food. But once you begin to kind of accept that food is chemical, you can start actually looking at what that means and what you can do with it.
And we have a question from the website.
According to the Anarchist Cookbook, one can get high from smoking banana skins. True? And if so, why? And that's from Evil Ray.
I don't know. I have not actually looked at that, nor heard that, nor have I tried it myself. The way I would answer this is I would start by looking at what compounds would be potentially present in there. And you could probably go to something like Bielitz et al.'s book, Food Chemistry, and look under banana in the index. And then there will be a table that essentially lists a lot of the known compounds in there. And then you could try to cross-reference that with, well, other tables I'm sure you can find on the internet. And I will give a plug here for books.google.com. It's actually a wonderful reference to be able to search a whole lot of books.
And we have another question from the chat room.
Why is it that not exactly following the recipe can actually lead to better cooking results? Or is that just a factor of experience? And that's from Bytor.
Good question. The thing to keep in mind with measurements and recipes is that they're just notes for what worked for somebody else. And what worked for somebody else might not have been ideal, or it could have been ideal in their environment, but different in your environment for a whole bunch of reasons. Let's start with something like flour. If you're looking at a recipe that involves flour and water, maybe you're making bread, going back to that, the humidity in your environment will be different to some degree than the humidity in the environment of what the person who you got the recipe from. And so your flour itself actually will have some amount of moisture present in it. And so the measurements that you're working with aren't going to be able to actually correctly capture that. Or likewise, if you're talking about spices, maybe you're making some sort of lasagna dish and somebody says, oh, you know, use just a teaspoon of oregano, and you go to use a teaspoon of oregano and like you hardly taste it. It may be that their oregano was much, much fresher and the compounds that were present in your oregano essentially broke down over time and lost some of their strength, because a lot of the compounds that are in things like oregano are actually kind of volatile and will break down. So I guess looking at recipes, just treat them as notes, treat them as guidelines, and improvise a little bit. And in fact, I actually really encourage people to go off recipe and try making a substitution. And after you make it, you think, oh, gee, it really could have used more of this. Make a note alongside the recipe saying more of this next time. Because really that's the best way to get a sense of learning what does work and what doesn't work and actually become a more experienced cook.
So let's talk a bit about storage of food, because this is actually one of those things that if you do it wrong, it can kill you. So what should we know about it that we don't?
Well, it's unlikely to kill you except for in the case of if you were to eat a lot of potatoes where the skin had gone green, and that actually can happen. There's a compound that actually causes potatoes to become poisonous. You'd actually have to eat a fair amount of potato skin to really have much more than an upset stomach, but you shouldn't do it. From a food storage point of view, really the biggest thing that you're going to impact is going to be the quality of the ingredient. So things like oregano are light sensitive and will break down, so you should actually store your spices in a dark place. A lot of the compounds present in spices as well are also not particularly heat stable, so you should not store them in, say, a cupboard above your stove or, you know, on a ledge right next to your stove. They should actually be put someplace away where it's cool and dry. Things like flour and grains can become infested with pantry weevils. And for those things, if you're concerned about them, it's more of a nuisance factor. You can actually take whatever the product is when you first bring it into your house and freeze it for a week or so. And that will actually kill those worms and moths. So it kind of depends specifically on what your goals are. But I would essentially say store your things and kind of go through them periodically and realize that as things get older, they do break down. And so if you're making something and it's not coming out the way you expect, it's not just as strong as you want it to be, it's probably something like the oregano or whatever spices you're using having broken down over time.
You mentioned freezing food, and freezing food doesn't kill bacteria, correct?
It does not kill bacteria, but it does kill parasites and worms. So you hopefully don't have a whole lot of bacteria in your bag of flour that you bought from the store. But things like meats, which can become contaminated, you need to cook them to a sufficiently high temperature to sufficiently pasteurize any pathogens that might be present.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're currently talking about how to avoid food-related death. I'm here with the author of Cooking for Geeks, Jeff Potter, and we are taking questions. Email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be right back with more after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we take a look at scientific consensus through the eyes of non-scientists. Skeptic North bloggers Steve Toms and Eric Davis explain how non-professional researchers can understand the state of modern science on questions from climate change to the effects of electromagnetic fields. And on Speaking Up, Skeptic brothers Tom and Nick Croucher talk about the placebo band, a project targeting the sometimes miraculous claims of applied kinesiology. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm talking with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food. So let's talk about taste specifically. You mentioned in the book that flavor doesn't really exist the way we perceive it. It's put together in the brain?
Yeah, flavor was one of these really fascinating things for me when I started really looking into it. We all have kind of a very simple model of how flavor works, but it's actually a lot more complicated than what you might initially suspect. So there's things like taste. Most of us kind of would say, yeah, there's, you know, your four primary tastes, sweet, sour, salty, and bitter. There's a fifth one called umami, which is essentially savory, which isn't really as important in Western culture. But still, there are sensors on your tongue that actually sense glutamate compounds, among other things, which is that sense. And there's some evidence beginning to mount that suggests we actually have sensors on our tongue for metallic compounds as well. Those taste buds have actually been found in dog tongues, and really we're not that different than dogs from a genetic, the way our taste system works. The other component of it is actually smell. And smell gets a whole lot more complicated than taste. Because essentially with taste, something runs across your tongue, trips off a sensor, and your brain goes, ah, salty. What happens with smell is that we have something kind of on the order of, oh, maybe around 1,000 different receptors in your nasal cavity. And as odorants pass through the nasal cavity, different numbers of these receptors, different types, basically fire off, kind of like notes on a piano. And your brain then registers those different sensors coming off and goes, ah, I'm going to call this strawberry. And in the case of strawberry, maybe it's, you know, hitting maybe 100 or so different actual like detectors in your nose. But it's a cord. It's not like there's a particularly like a strawberry odor detector in your nose. It's that the actual odors of strawberry trigger different sensors. Now, with the case of something like strawberry, it actually gets even more complicated because strawberry is not just one odorant. There's not just one compound, but a whole bunch of different compounds. If you take something like clove is actually a little bit easier. There's one compound, eugenol, which essentially, if you smell that one compound, eugenol, and you can go and buy a synthetically generated bottle of it from Sigma, you'll say clove. But strawberry has like hundreds of different compounds that your brain has to actually recognize all kind of simultaneously. So it's actually kind of like this huge chord of all these different notes that are playing. And this is why creating artificial strawberry extract is so difficult. Because if you want to make an artificial strawberry extract, you have to do enough of these different compounds such that your nose fires off enough receptors such that your brain goes, ah, it's kind of close to strawberry, I'll call it strawberry. Whereas other compounds, like vanilla, are actually much easier to create synthetic artificial versions, because really there's only one compound in vanilla, it's actually called vanillin, that causes our nose to detect that flavor and fire off that sensation. So flavor itself really is the combination of taste in your tongue, smell from your nose, and a little bit of like textural and cellular irritation and kind of some other stuff that happens on your tongue. So once you kind of have this model, you can kind of start seeing why things like artificial strawberry don't taste so well, or why if you allow something to cook too long and it breaks down, where you lose some of the odorants, why it tastes or smells different. And taste itself really is very much kind of a confusing word. When I say taste there, I mean actually the flavor of it, because taste right. can mean both the gustatory system and how it tastes, i.e. what your brain fuses together from taste, smell, and the texture and cellular irritation bits.
And we have a call from Liam in Edmonton.
I was hoping I could just ask a question. Hopefully no one got to it before me. I kind of jumped into the show halfway through. I was wondering what would be the top five foods that may cause euphoria?
Interesting.
You know, I think that's probably going to be very, very subjective based on who you're talking to. So for me, it would be German chocolate cake, apricot jam, probably like a fresh tomato, and I mean like a really good tomato, not one of these like styrofoam tasting things. But these are all things that actually come from my childhood, things that are flavors that bring me back to particular points where it really is about the sensory, the memory of that experience. So I think it's not so easy to say that there's a particular physiological, chemical answer to that, because I think actually the psychological bit is going to be way more important. I suppose you could probably, you know, going back to what I said earlier, chocolate would probably get you kind of there. But that might just because as a culture, we all hype up chocolate. I mean, we do the same thing with coffee, right? So who's to say that necessarily it's actually a physiological basis in chocolate? Maybe it's a psychological. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's where I would guess it would come from.
Now, actually, you also mentioned in the book that we develop a taste for bitterness and lose our taste for sweetness as we get older.
Bitterness is actually one of these kind of instinctive survival things that we as humans have developed because many plants that are poisonous are bitter. And so essentially, plants advertise, "Don't eat me, I am poisonous," by being bitter, and we don't eat them because they are bitter. But bitter is something that can be learned to be enjoyed. So if you look at things like dandelion greens, or even actually coffee can be kind of bitter, although you can cancel it out with some sugar or some cream. These are things that actually, as we go on over time, that we learn to enjoy. And similarly, sweetness seems to be related to, actually, there was a study that linked it to, I think, bone growth in children. So like, if you look at the desire for sweet things, it seems to be correlated with the amount of like growth that a person is going through physiologically. And so it kind of follows from that when you stop getting larger, at least in terms of bone structure, that you basically don't have as much of a craving for those essentially very quick and easily digestible calories that your body might be able to use for fueling growth.
And we have another call from Brian in Edmonton.
Yeah, just a very quick comment. A while ago you were talking about whether a pint of penis would be different volume in Canada than in the United States, and it would be, because a pint of penis in Canada would be 20 imperial ounces, which is roughly 507 milliliters, and in the States it would be 16 American ounces, which is 473 milliliters.
Good point. I suppose this is kind of like the question of which weighs more, an ounce of gold or an ounce of feathers, and it comes down to, well, gold is measured in troy ounces, so yeah. Actually they're different.
So, drink your Guinness in Canada.
Sounds good.
Now, you actually bring up some very interesting neurology in the book, such as how people who define reason one way or another might indicate how they taste some things. Can you explain that?
Yeah, this was actually one of the very first interviews I did, and it was very confusing at first. And there's a researcher down at Cornell who had been looking at something called trigeminal sensitivity. Essentially, some people's physiology, at least as her preliminary research suggests, means that they taste things on their tongue like peppermint candies or spicy foods as stronger than other people. So things like menthol, which is the compound that gives that cooling effect to peppermint candies, or capsaicin, which is one of the compounds that makes food spicy, these essentially work by cellular irritation. And so it seems that if the cranial nerve that actually links that part of the tongue into your brain is more well connected, shall we say, you experience those things stronger. Now, that same cranial nerve pathway, the way it hooks in, may actually tie into the regions of the brain that deal with logic and decision making. And so there may actually be some interesting correlations there with people that taste these things as exceedingly hot or exceedingly cooling as also being more logically driven in a certain way. Now, capsaicin gets a little bit tricky to actually include in that conversation, because capsaicin itself is detected through something called substance P. It's a neurotransmitter that essentially gets depleted in the act of actually firing off. And so you actually can become adapted to eating spicier food. And this actually is the sort of thing that takes a couple of weeks. Your substance P levels can be depleted over the course of several weeks. And if you stop eating spicy food, over the course of another several weeks, the substance P levels will rebuild themselves. But this is why some dishes will taste exceedingly spicy to some people who aren't used to spicy foods, whereas to somebody else it's not hot at all. It's because quite simply they have different substance P levels. It's actually the same researcher who told me this great story of having students from India coming over to Cornell, and they didn't have particularly spicy food in Ithaca at the time. And so they stopped eating spicy food, their substance P levels replenished, and then for the holidays they would go home and visit their parents, and their substance P levels had replenished, so all the food was exceedingly spicy, and the mothers would say things like, "What has America done to you? You can't stand my cooking anymore." And it actually just turned out to be that, no, there's a physiological explanation here.
Interesting.
And it was like, wow, that actually makes so much sense. So the physiological bits of taste have so many little turns and twists, and so much of it seems unknown at this point. There's another phenomenon in tasting called supertasting, where some people taste some set of compounds as more bitter than other people. But this particular difference was discovered completely by accident, and it's not one that seems to be of major importance in cooking, but it's kind of interesting to talk about. But there might be other ones that are actually very important that we just don't know about, because how would you know? I mean, you've never been able to taste with somebody else's tongue. And so if people really do have great differences in the way we taste, it's kind of tricky to actually even notice that.
This question was submitted on the chat room, and ordinarily I wouldn't allow it through, but really, who am I to kill a meme?
Why is bacon so tasty chemically? And that's from Brian Gregory.
Bacon is so tasty because it has a lot of salt, it has a lot of fat, and when you cook it, you get all those Maillard reactions occurring, and so you get all these compounds that kind of contribute to flavors that we happen to really enjoy. Salty and sweet things seem to really fire off your brain for a whole lot of reasons. And it seems that the combination of the two kind of overstimulates the brain in ways that independently they don't really. So essentially, bacon is a perfect little storm of deliciousness.
You realize that itself, that phrase, will become a meme.
I look forward to it, yes.
So I do want to talk about one thing. We have about 3 minutes left. But you pioneered a way of making ice cream in about 30 seconds using some fairly advanced technology. Do you want to just tell us about that?
I cannot claim to have pioneered it. Using liquid nitrogen to make ice cream was first done, as far as I know, in 1906 at the World's Fair. So it's been made this way for over 100 years. But essentially, liquid nitrogen is so cold that if you mix it in with cream and whatever other flavors you want to put into your ice cream, well, that cream will basically freeze instantly. And as a result of it freezing so quickly, the ice crustal structure in the ice cream is really, really fine. And so you get this ice cream that has the smoothest, most incredible texture that you could ever imagine. And the other really fun thing about using liquid nitrogen to make ice cream is that you can freeze things that don't normally freeze, i.e. ethanol. So all your alcohol won't freeze under traditional ice cream making methods because it doesn't get cold enough. But with liquid nitrogen being at negative 320 degrees Fahrenheit, it most definitely will freeze a bottle of Bailey's or Goldschlager or whatever else you want to throw into your ice cream. So you can actually make ice creams that will give you a hangover. But they're delicious.
Everybody in the booth is very excited by this concept. Would you like to give a disclaimer, sir, about handling liquid nitrogen at all?
I would say if you're going to handle liquid nitrogen, you really need to understand there are three main safety aspects. And this is actually covered in Chapter 7 in my book, but they are really quickly. One, nitrogen is not oxygen, so it can asphyxiate you. If it displaces all of the air in the room, you'll die. Two, it's cold. It's really, really cold. So make sure that you wear protective gear. Really the most important thing essentially are goggles to prevent any splashes from hitting your eye. Just like you would not want a drop of hot fat fryer oil to hit your eye, you don't want a drop of liquid nitrogen to hit your eye. And then lastly, realize that liquid nitrogen boils, right? And things that boil, if they're put inside a closed container, can become essentially a pressure bomb. So if you've got liquid nitrogen, you need to be really careful that the container that you're holding it in, which is a dewar is the term for it, doesn't somehow seal up or otherwise get closed. It's not particularly dangerous to handle if you are aware of the issues, but if you just handle it blindly, not having really done your homework, you can cause some serious problems.
And on that note, we are out of time. Jeff, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. And I would say the liquid nitrogen stuff is fun. Go do it, but be careful.
You can watch a video of Jeff playing with ice cream and liquid nitrogen on his blog, which is a companion blog to the book, at cookingforgeeks.com. And we, of course, are at skepticallyspeaking.com. Head there to check out our recently redesigned and almost completely bug-free website. Click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, to iTunes, and you can listen to past episodes and subscribe to the show. While you're there, do leave us maybe a wonderfully complimentary review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, woo. I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone. We don't need them anymore. Just
just a microscope, telescope, magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.